You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Washington Post reporters and Pulitzer Prize winners Carol Lennig and Philip Rucker's new book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year, is on bookshelves right now. Now, this book gives us a comprehensive rundown of President Trump's tweet storms, as well as the denial and the desperation that was coming out of the White House from January of 2020 until January of 2021. It also goes behind the scenes, looking at the White House as well as federal agencies who were tasked with dealing with COVID-19, as well as protests over police brutality, the insurrection on January 6th, and finally, the transfer of power to now President Biden. Joining us today to talk more about this is Carol Lennig. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Gemma. I'm excited for talking with you.
Well, I have to say, I spent the weekend reading this book, and I found it to be fascinating. For folks who don't know, the book actually begins where your last book, A Very Stable Genius, ended. So we're entering Trump's last year in office, when he's really beginning to hear rumblings of the coronavirus. And Carol, he's not necessarily that concerned about it, because he's really focused on this the Russia investigation and his impeachment.
That's right. He is a little bit distracted, to say the least. He's facing impeachment. The House has voted to impeach him, and the Senate is conducting a trial where they will decide whether or not to convict in this time period. It's also the time period where the CDC director gets an emergency, New Year's Eve email, and ultimately it leads to a couple phone calls, but an email alerting him that there's been a strange and unexplained respiratory pneumonia-like virus in Wuhan, China. And the reason that he gets that alert is because it's an unexplained pneumonia. It's one of the things he's been fearful of during his career, because he thinks one of these kinds of viruses is going to come back. Maybe a bird flu, maybe something else is going to come back, and it's going to be hard to fight off, and it's going to spread around the world. It's something he actually predicted, and now he's on guard. But the president doesn't really want to hear about this, because when Alex Azar, his health secretary, tries to tell Trump about it, Trump just kind of kicks him to the curb in the conversation and begins immediately talking over him and saying, Alex, you're going to lose me the election. You made me ban those flavorings in e-cigarettes, and now the vapors don't like me. You're going to cost me the election. Azar tries to explain to him that the president can use this as an excellent talking point, that, he's protected public health. And the president says, I just need the vapors. Like, we got to get that ban removed. I should have never let you talk me into that. Azar tries to return to the topic of the actual virus they're dealing with, a real public health crisis on the hustings. And Trump hangs up on him.
So what I find incredible is this part about the e-cigarettes. And I should note that there are 140 some sources that you and Philip Rucker interviewed for this book, including you actually had a sit down interview with President Trump, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But when I was reading this and the e-cigarettes, I mean, I literally was like, what? E-cigarettes? What? Because it seems so ridiculous, frankly, in where we are now, right? When you fast forward. But with that said, what was interesting to me is that there was a part in the book where you write about where Alex Azar, who is the Health and Human Services Secretary, basically talks about how Trump did not know that the CDC reported to HHS. So there is such a disconnect, it seems, as we are entering this pandemic.
Oh, in so many ways. I mean, the president isn't really taking in information that he's not interested in many settings. That one thing we learned in the book is he doesn't understand the moment you fixate on it's fascinating because there's so much there.
I know.
The president is livid and yelling at Azar over the phone because of testing. He says, I'm getting killed on testing. Who was the idiot who thought that the government should do testing for the virus? You know, everybody's talking about testing. And what the president means there is that there is great concern that there aren't enough tests to go around to try to control the virus. The more you know where the virus is and who is infected, the better you can separate these two populations, infected and non-infected. And the Trump administration is facing intense criticism for the fact that there was not widespread production of enough tests to do this work. Unfortunately, the president confuses the production of those tests and the availability with the fact that the CDC is the model for the test, and the model is not working that well. So he's livid. He's not livid that they don't have enough tests. He's not livid that the test doesn't work. He's livid that the government is taking responsibility for testing people and giving and generating numbers of how bad the virus spread is. Just amazing. He also doesn't understand how the government works with regard to, you know, who reports to who. The FDA, the CDC, these are parts of the larger Health and Human Services. And later, the president also rejects a key fact in this drama that Alex Azar has tried to communicate to him many, many times, that Robert Redfield, the CDC director, has tried to communicate to him many, many times. And that is that masks work to protect people from getting the virus and to protect from spreading it. And twice in the fall of 2020, when many, many people, 200,000 people have died in America from COVID, the president seems surprised to learn that masks work.
And the thing is, too, with this is, I mean, these two times, it's because Alex Azar continues to wear a mask inside the White House, consistently does that, even though so many people do not. And frankly, becomes a super spreader at the White House. The president looks at him almost in surprise, as you write in the book, when Alex Azar says, Mr. President, the masks work. And he says to him, they do. And the first time I was like, oh, okay, I get it. But the second time, I was like, didn't they just have this conversation?
I'm told in our reporting that Alex Azar had the same reaction that you did.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad I'm not alone. Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Anthony Fauci. We know that there, you know, Trump says in the book, basically, he's like, I like the guy. I don't have anything against him. He just kind of didn't like what he was saying, frankly. But then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows called Fauci a fearmonger. And it seems that Meadows was the one who didn't want Fauci going in front of cameras because of the information that he was telling people.
Absolutely. You know, the happy talk that the president was pushing, Mark Meadows became the enforcer for that. And when he arrives in March of 2020, he begins this incredibly disciplined rooting out of any expert, medical health, government expert, who's typically free to speak to the public about public health, shockingly. He begins pulling all those people off of television and reporting interview schedules, basically saying, I don't want you talking on television or doing any interviews because this is not matching with our happy talk. Now, the way Meadows says it is a little different, but one time he calls up the chief of staff to Alex Azar. He has just seen Fauci on television talking about how this is becoming a pandemic. Fauci was absolutely right at that stage. The virus was becoming a pandemic. A pandemic is something that has passed to most of the continents of the country. And Meadows' head explodes when he sees this, calls the chief of staff for Azar and says, get him off the air right now. He cannot do this anymore. It happens over and over again. Meadows' PR staff and political staff block the experts from talking to the public. It's like putting a lid on truth.
I think that you make a very compelling case that President Trump's failure, frankly, concerning the handling of the pandemic, was selfishness. It seems that he was more concerned about self than country, and it seems that that's a theme within his 4 years in office. Is that a correct assessment?
Sadly, it is. Donald Trump put self above country, put self above democracy, put self above the integrity of our elections, put self even above his own base, you know, because now they are getting sick, having bought his story that the vaccine was, the virus was a hoax. He put self above the lives of Americans in a short-term strategy, right? Every day he wanted to win the news cycle. He wanted to get reelected, and he thought this was the great way to do it. Unfortunately, President Trump's toolkit for victory and leadership and governing, the one that had worked for him as a real estate developer, the one that had worked for him as a reality TV show personality, the one that actually had slightly worked for him in the beginning of the presidency, was so woefully inadequate for a real crisis. And I think about this a lot because in reporting for our first book, Stable Genius, many of the people we interviewed said, we're so lucky we haven't hit a crisis yet because we don't know what would happen then. And then when we began reporting for I Alone Can Fix It, we learned that they totally foreshadowed where we ended up. They totally predicted the failures that would come.
We need to take a quick break. We're going to continue this conversation with Kara Linick. She is one of the co-authors of the new book, I Alone Can Fix It. Continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning author and Washington Post reporter Kara Linick about her new book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. She co-wrote this with colleague Philip Rucker. There's so much to get to. We have about 5 minutes. So I really want to get to January 6th. And what struck me about this, Carol, really was his daughter, Ivanka Trump. Mm-hmm. I was not expecting her reaction. This, frankly, was shocking to me. She at one point says that Mike Pence is a good man. She's upset about her father's badgering of him to try to negate the putting Biden into office. Talk a little bit about this. I mean, am I the only one who had this reaction?
You're not the only one who had this reaction. And I would say that, you know, Ivanka Trump, through the reporting that we did, comes out as a person who is not very forceful with her father when she's disappointed or concerned. So she kind of has these concerns and shares them with her aides, but that doesn't mean she lays down the law with her dad as often as she might be concerned. Remember, she and her husband actually were pretty progressive, democratic leaning in their politics before before her father became president. To be fair, so was Donald Trump before he became president. But she's a little bit disturbed by this attack on Pence, and also I think probably believes that this is not going to end well, that a battle between a president and a vice president over the transfer of a power could be quite tectonic in terms of the plates shifting. She also, on January 6th, is the person who is called in after the violence breaks out on Capitol Hill, and her father is sort of, you know, on his heels, wondering what this all means for him. She is the person brought in with Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to try to get her father to issue a real statement, to call off the dogs, to stop the violence on the Hill, because these are his supporters. And they essentially went there and repeatedly have admitted that in court. They went there because he told them to. So she struggles with that. And a couple of people who were in the White House at the time told us that she was sort of like the stable pony for the racehorse, you know, brought in to bring her father back to a safe trot instead of this adrenalized giddiness that his supporters were doing what he told them to do.
And before I let you go, there's so much to get to. People really should read this, in particular about what happens on January 6th. You have a sit-down interview with President Trump in March at Mar-a-Lago, not in his private offices, in the lobby where everyone can see this. And in fact, it goes on so long that people start showing up and saying hello, including his son's girlfriend and some Fox News hosts. Was it surreal? It just seemed surreal when I was reading it.
It was quite a scene, I've got to say, Gemma. It was so amazing in many ways. One of the ways is that, you know, it's like the president, the former president's own Brigadoon. It's his castle, mm-hmm. his exile, and he's living as if he is still president there. You know, we are there in the lobby where he arranged for us to sit, presumably so people can see us as they come in for the dinner hour and know that more and more people are, you know, wanting an audience with Donald Trump. He, after speaking to us again generously for 2 hours and 45 minutes, during that time, Laura Ingraham strolls in, you know, the Fox News anchor, to tell him to tune into her program. She's really going to have one really critical of the doctors who've been critical of the president. She heads off to dinner. Kimberly Guilfoyle comes in, sort of obsequiously walks over tenderly to ask Donald Trump, can she have him come over to her table and say hello to her friends who are her guests that night? Dan Crenshaw comes over, one of the many lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who are trekking to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring, mm-hmm. to win his endorsement, because he still is incredibly powerful in the party and can help them with their reelection. It's all this cinema, this theater, in which he's still president in a way, he's still the king. And when our interview was over, he stepped out onto his patio where the dining guests at the club had gathered, and they played Hail to the Chief, and everyone stood for a standing ovation.
It is his own Brigadoon. I so appreciate you taking time out of your day. This book was truly fascinating. Again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
We've been talking with Carol Lennig. She is co-author with Philip Rucker of the new book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. It is out in bookstores and, of course, online right now. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters today. My producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.